Thank you for joining us today for the 14th episode of the Whitaker Report podcast, a discussion with thought leaders about the future of economic development, site selection, and corporate real estate. My name is Dean Whitaker, President and CEO of Whitaker Associates, a data analytic company serving the needs of economic development and commercial real estate organizations. I will be your host as we endeavor to see what's next, to see around the corner. Today we will be speaking with Kate McEnroe. Kate is the founder of Kate McEnroe Consulting, which is a sole proprietorship founded in 1993 as a location selection and economic development consulting firm through designing high-impact business cases for workforce assets, deploying marketing resources, and applying data visualization principles to the task of marketing places. Thank you for joining us today, Kate. It's our pleasure to have an opportunity to talk with you about some of the work that you do. And one of the things I was curious about in looking at your website is the term wayfinding, and then the other term you had was positioning. Can you help me understand what is meant by those two terms and how you use them?
Well, I think one of the things that I think about over the course of the time I've been doing this work, and of course I've worked as a sole proprietor for many, many years. So branding for me is going to be different than it's going to be for a large firm. That's one issue. And the other issue is that I, over the years, got to the point where I wanted to be more someone who was in the interpretation business than in the raw data business. I wanted to live for clients at a place that was sort of at the top of that, you know, data, information, knowledge, wisdom pyramid. And so I was looking for terminology that would help people understand that I didn't necessarily want to, I wanted to help frame the question. I didn't just want to be someone that kind of said, well, I'll fill in all these little data points. I want to help frame the question. And I remember coming across, you know, this idea of wayfinding technically is there are people who do this. You go to certain cities. And it's easy to find your way around either because the streets are gridded or often because there's people that are invisible that are really, really good at signage and really good at visually showing you how to get where you want to go. And then there are other places where you find yourself getting lost all the time. And I could name one or two. And I remember being in some of those places and thinking, well, there's some great things here, but I can't. I've been here a long time and I'm still kind of lost and I'm still kind of confused. So I try and position myself to be somebody who can, you know, kind of find order out of chaos or find the path forward. And so that's what caused me to adopt this wayfinding idea. And I feel like it helped me come up with a term that could apply to the different audiences that I work with as well. I have the ability, because I'm a sole proprietor, I think, to be a little bit more personally branded and worry a little less about, you know, things that would translate to a large corporate identity scheme. I also am, you know, my alter ego is more artist than business person, so it appealed to me from that point of view, too. And as far as, you know, positioning goes, I think a lot of, you know, the corporate side of the business is about getting the entity, getting the enterprise positioned in the right place to have the most success. I think on the economic development side, it's getting the economic developer themselves, the economic development organization, positioned correctly both inside their community in terms of getting the support that they need, having people understand what they do and why they do it, and how they're connected there, as well as I remember taking a course in grad school called Positioning the Battle for Your Mind, and it was a marketing course. And so I thought it was also a good term to help people understand how do you occupy a position in the mind of consultants or corporations that you want to bring in? How do you help your community and your economic development organization gain a position in someone else's mind, get access to some of the real estate in their memory?
That's fascinating. I made a note here. Mind share is what comes to mind. You know, how much of a person's mind do you have? Getting and keeping people's attention, it feels like has become increasingly difficult. Is that the case in the work you do?
Well, I think it is true, because I think that there are so many people trying to hijack your mind and monetize that hijacking, you know, in our personal lives and in our business lives. I think that there is so much input out there that, you know, potential corporate prospects could develop a point of view about a community based on any number of random inputs mm-hmm. they're exposed to. And so I think a big part of the job of the economic developer is to do whatever they can do to influence that narrative, to first of all recognize what that narrative may be, however, you know, accurate or inaccurate or fair or unfair it may be, mm-hmm. and say, you know, my job is to come in and try to influence that narrative. And that's not just going to be done, you know, data points alone are not going to do that. Sales pitching alone is not going to do that. I think that's why you hear so much now about, you know, advising people who are representing communities that their power is going to be in their narrative, which is just another word for the storytelling word we hear all the time.
Very interesting. What trends are you seeing in the, both positioning and in wayfinding? What kind of trends are you seeing?
Well, you know, I would say over the years, we have a tendency in all fields, really, and so economic development is not exempt, you know, to jump on certain bandwagons. And, of course, the problem with that is that when that happens, it becomes incredibly difficult to distinguish yourself from other places. So, you know, we had during the pandemic this bandwagon of, oh, everybody's going to leave the big cities and this is going to be the moment for our small and rural areas to, you know, have a leg up on this problem they've been facing of, you know, trying to get people to come in and move. And so there was a lot of jumping on that bandwagon. I've written things over the years about how we go through different eras where different kinds of what I call swag are popular, where all of a sudden everybody sort of is pushing the exact same, you know, message, the exact same themes. So we've gone through, you know, periods where we sort of grab onto terminology, and when it comes from everywhere, it loses a lot of its meaning. So, you know, right now we're getting that. I think we're seeing that's a little... that's peaked and maybe faded, because we are now understanding that the big cities are not, in fact, entirely emptying out. We don't know what's going to happen in terms of are people going back to offices or not going back to offices. I certainly think or hope that one of the things that has become clarified that most people in the business knew about, but that I'm hopeful will get some attention, is what really has to happen with broadband. Mm. Throughout the country. I think a lot of people were surprised to find out how many places that they thought had the density to have good broadband, in fact, did not. I think this is one of those things where, not to get too far in the weeds, but, you know, there were only a few places that were really measuring it the correct way, and so who really knew what their circumstances were. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see honest to God, ubiquitous broadband. I think that will make a big difference. I think we will start to see, I mean, I've been talking probably for about 30 years about communities and political, with a small p, subdivisions and jurisdictions, trying to figure out what to do about revenue streams that are disconnected potentially from place-based work. So in other words, from property tax, because there have been, you know, rumblings for years, little tiny raindrops, and now we're sort of in a thunderstorm, you know, of companies adopting a model that didn't necessarily aggregate all of their entity in one physical place that could generate a bunch of property taxes. So I think as it relates not just to incentives, we hear about incentives for remote workers and this and that, but also structurally around, you know, municipal and state funding models, there may need to be some adaptation along those lines.
Yeah, well, with the implementation of broadband, it means the remote worker can work anywhere. I had a chance to work on a project recently, and I learned that there are resorts in the Caribbean now that specializes in what are digital nomads and people that can work anywhere. And so, and that seems to be a growing trend in terms of people that want the freedom. One of my colleagues, she just bought her second sailboat, and her dream is to become a digital nomad on her sailboat and, yeah. and work from there.
But of course, that's I think that's true. You know, there is a cruise line that's catering to that. But that's also a very, because the other trend I think is happening is you're seeing an awful lot more economic development organizations in their strategic planning efforts speak more to equitable economic development and inclusive economic development. And when we talk about digital nomads and remote workers, that's a privileged thing.
Very much.
Okay, so that's not, I mean, we have also seen that we are going to be a distribution center dependent, world. And if those don't work, we don't work. Mm-hmm. We, I think, are going to see, you know, potentially more around the world. I think people are, this has been talked about so much, but, you know, reevaluating supply chain and what really is the trade-off between, you know, transportation costs and transportation risks versus higher production costs closer to closer to wherever the consumer market is. So all that digital nomad remote worker, all that kind of stuff, I mean, that's great, but that's a very that's the privileged end of the argument.
Very niche.
So there's another whole world that does not apply to, but that has a lot more to do with, you know, kids being able to go to school or being able to deliver training or, I mean, that aspect of broadband that I think is important, or being able to even put some of these manufacturing and distribution facilities that are either highly automated or highly networked into places that, you know, might not have been able to support that kind of thing as well in the past, or small towns who want to hang on to their own workers, you know, who want to have that kind of infrastructure as part of their quality of life, to work in situ, I guess I would say, jobs, as opposed to, you know, remote jobs. So I do see another trend of, I've seen probably 3 or 4 RFPs come out that aren't your traditional, you know, labor force study or aren't your traditional strategic plan, but that are more about inclusiveness. Now, you know, to be clear, a lot of that is mutualized self-interest. We are certainly at a point where, to whatever degree automation takes over, it's not going to take over completely enough or quickly enough to make it okay for us to just sort of not worry about bringing as many people into the workforce as we can, and not worry about meeting them where we can. I'm also hopeful. I don't know if this is a trend. To me, there was a very disturbing trend a few months ago around the idea of, you know, all this conversation that was coming out around, you know, people are lazy and we're paying them to stay home. And I felt like, any system that human beings put in place, somebody will find, you know, some portion, there'll be a few people that find a way to game that system. But I felt it was very unproductive, and I challenged economic development leaders to not lean into that conversation, not let that take their local discourse into a cul-de-sac, because what it does is it allows you to ignore some of the real things that need to be handled, like childcare, like transportation challenges, like things that are keeping people that would be good employees for anyone from being able to be. And so I am hopeful that that trend, that was a little blip in a moment and not a trend, to sort of, you know, shame people, because I didn't understand why people were denigrating the people that they were supposedly trying to hire. I didn't think that was a very effective strategy. And if in fact people are, you know, not of the character you want, then I don't know why that you want them to come to work for you anyway. So we all only have so much energy. We all only have so much money. We all only have so much time. So I'm hopeful, and I see signs, and this is why I write about it in a place I'll remember every month, of places that are saying, yeah, we're not gonna take our energy down that road. We're gonna take our energy down the problem solving road. And some of this problem solving is happening on a what looks like a micro level, but it's fixing things. So I'm hopeful for micro solutions. I think in some cases we've held too high a standard of saying, you know, well, if it won't scale or if it won't fix everybody, then we can't put any energy into it. And, you know, I've said recently to a lot of people, we don't successfully launch our most privileged kids with a 90% success rate into, you know, the workforce and independence. And so to expect, I think sometimes we have unrealistic expectations of some of the programs we've put in place for people that have transportation or childcare or training challenges, you know, for what we expect them to produce, I think sometimes is unrealistic. So I think I see a trend of positive things happening in that direction where we're working micro solutions, and we're attacking some of the things that are really going to make a day-to-day difference in people's lives, partly by asking them what they need.
Mm-hmm. Can you give a couple examples of these micro solutions that you're seeing happening out there?
Yeah. So one that I wrote about is, and it has spread to different places in the country, but I wrote about Wilson County, North Carolina, and they took their leadership class. You know, a lot of communities have these leadership programs, leadership through a chamber or through another SHIP organization. And there were people not engaged in the workforce. And, you know, there were a lot of people engaged in the workforce sort of pointing at that everywhere in the country and saying, you know, what's the problem? Is it this? Is it that? Is it just character? Is it a bad, you know, paper trail? And so they took some of those people, and instead of doing, you know, a quote-unquote survey online, which isn't usually effective for people that might be disengaged, they went to some of these places people were. From my understanding, they went to some unemployment offices, they went to some food pantries, and they asked them questions. And I don't think they worried a whole lot about getting statistically significant samples across a broad range. They asked people questions. And what they found out was there was a number of people who were highly employable already. It wasn't, and the big issue was transportation and reliable transportation. They had a bus system. The bus system didn't go to and from where it needed to when it needed to in order to make work for these people. And so, and I'm, you know, I may get some of these minor details wrong, but they partnered with an organization called Via Transportation in this particular case, which is a private company that had pre-existed. And they basically scrapped the bus system and replaced it with microtransit routes, vans. That, you know, for years and years, we've talked about van pooling, getting employees together, and maybe the big company provides the van, and sometimes it takes off, sometimes it doesn't. But they've been highly successful in being able to really identify, okay, where is there a cluster of people that need to be picked up, and where does that cluster of people need to go to, and when do they need to go, and it's a much more highly flexible system. They've won national awards for it. And, you know, you could look and say, well, did it affect 10,000 people? No. But, you know, has it made a difference for, you know, some of the people and some of the companies that really needed to be put together? Yeah, it did. And, you know, they just reimagined the whole concept in this particular case of public transit. So I think something like that is interesting. I think another program that I find interesting, there's a guy in Chicago. This is something I heard him give at a Chicago Ideas Week, I believe it was, conference. So there's a gentleman that used to run Chicago Public Schools, and then he was Obama's Secretary of Education, and he now works for, I'm embarrassed, I cannot remember her first name. Steve Jobs' widow now runs a very large not-for-profit, and I should remember her first name because it's not fair to call her Steve Jobs' widow. But in any case, she runs something called the Edison Project. And he talked about going into some disadvantaged neighborhoods in Chicago and talking to some people, some young men, who were part of the biggest business in the neighborhood, which was a drug selling business. Mm-hmm. And he talked to some of them in their early 20s who were sort of the lieutenants. And they weren't getting rich. I mean, they weren't making a ton of money. And he said, you know, what would it take for you to do another job instead of this job? And the way he tells the story, they said, if there was a job that was sort of in my neighborhood, in my, you know, somewhere nearby, that paid me $12 an hour, I would have made a different decision. Wow. I made a decision. And he said, these are smart business people. They're good marketers. They're good with money. They're good salesmen. Mm-hmm. They manage people. I mean, how whatever they're doing it in service of, these are skills that are there. And they basically said, I looked around. I have things I want. I have maybe family to support. I took the best job there was in my neighborhood, and this was it. And if there had been a $12 an hour job, I would have taken that. And they start from there. And they are starting to say, okay, you know, what would that look like? And I believe they have begun with construction. And the challenge he's also made is, you know, to companies, you're going to have to come in. You're going to have to put some of your skin in the game, too, just as they're putting skin in the game. I'm hopeful another trend is that companies will start to understand and consultants will be bold enough to say to them, sometimes you don't have a where problem. I mean, our problem has always been about geography and evaluating geography and comparing geography. And my sweet spot has always been labor, but I've always maintained that, you know, humans in one, the workforce in one state is not fundamentally and based on their character different than the workforce in another state. If that were true, we wouldn't all be trying to recruit people to move from one place to another. Sometimes companies don't have a where problem. Sometimes they have a different lever they need to push or pull.
We did a project recently for a client where we actually helped them to recruit talent to the community because they had so many open positions, and particularly two skill sets. One was maintenance mechanics, the other was nurses. And one of the things we learned in the process of doing it, the companies turned out to be their biggest obstacle themselves. And it got back to the hiring process was antiquated and wasn't current with some of the millennials that they were trying to hire. For example, one company, it would take a very long time, multiple weeks, in order to have your resume reviewed and invited in to interview. Are you seeing some changes along how companies are operating to make themselves more attractive?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm gonna go on, you know, there's the community side of that that needs to fix it for the benefit of the community. I'm not worried about those millennials because those millennials are gonna find a job. I should say I'm not worried about them, but I'm going to give you an example that speaks, you know, to even people that where both sides have a problem, where the company has a problem and the person has a problem. I shouldn't say I'm not worried about those millennials. I think a lot of those people in that regard, if you have that kind of training, you are going to find an opportunity with the company and in the community that mm-hmm. gets with it fastest. So the communities will suffer. The people with the skills, whatever their ages may be, may be frustrated, but fundamentally they have skills that are in demand. But I want to tell a story about, so Jamie Dimon runs Chase Bank, and he recently did an op-ed piece, and he talked about the fact, and I apologize, I don't have this in front of me, so I'm going to get my numbers a little bit wrong. But, you know, he talked about this whole idea of when do you check the box or not check the box on an employment application, and checking the box means, you know, it could say something like, have you ever been arrested for a felony, or have you ever been, it says different things for different companies. And there's a movement that says, leave that off the first application, because there's so much room for nuance that people are tossing, you know, resumes that they shouldn't be tossing anymore, especially because you've got people who were convicted of things, or maybe not even convicted, but arrested of things that aren't even crimes anymore. Specifically, I'm talking about a lot of minor drug offenses. So he talked about, you know, I've seen things come into different places. There's a number of places doing things called expungement clinics that help people get things expunged from their records. And I'm not talking about violent criminals who, you know, who serve their time. I'm talking about fairly minor stuff. But the process for getting those things off your record can be very costly and very confusing. So So there was something recently in Memphis where they had a big clinic with a church and some volunteer lawyers, and they processed hundreds of people through. And those people were now able to access housing, access jobs. So that's the people side of it. The company side of it is saying, we're not going to screen you out up front on that basis. And he talked about they hired like 10% of their total workforce. It was thousands of people of their hires. I can't remember. I have the specifics in the write-up I did of it on my blog. But a substantial portion of the people that Chase Bank had hired across the country in 2021, I believe. I can't remember if it was 2020 or 2021. Were people that would have not gone through the system. And he said they're excellent workers. They're doing fine. Obviously, they're not. If someone was, had a problem with financial crimes or something, they're not going to hire him at a bank. But I am seeing companies taking a little more nuanced point of view. There's a manufacturer in Indiana. I think I write these things and then I don't remember exactly who it was. But there's a manufacturer in Indiana that was tired of people failing the drug test and then disappearing, and created a program that said, if you come in here and I want to hire you and you fail a drug test, I'm going to pay for you to go to a 30-day outpatient rehab. And if you successfully do that, come back in and test clean, I'll hire you. So there's little points of light out there where people are taking a little more nuanced point of view.
It's very interesting. If you workforce has been one of your fortes for a long time. Any other trends that you see in the workforce going forward? What will work look like in the next 5 years or so? What do you see happening?
Well, I mean, again, like so many things, I think, there is this break between people who are doing work that can be done that is not place dependent. Mm-hmm. That's one sort of type of work. And I think for work that is not strictly place dependent, that also correlates sometimes, with individuals who have leverage in the sense that their skills are in demand. So I think that, there's going to be more randomness in what work looks like. I think there's going to be a wider variety of different patterns of what work and work life and workplace looks like. Now, if you look at things that have to be done in place somewhere because you are working on or with or fixing a piece of machinery that can't live in your house, or, or you are related to warehouse work or those sorts of things. I mean, long before COVID hit and long before remote work, became stylish, we had demographic trends in place. And we've been on a collision course between demographic trends and automation trends, right, for a long time. I think automation is absolutely coming. I also think, we were supposed to be living in a paperless environment now, and we're not. And I think we're going to need people who have higher skills, who are in a position to do repair and maintenance and all those sorts of things. And I think they're going to have more leverage. I think that for, at least the next little period of time here, people who are able to have those skills are going to be people that have more leverage. And I think companies aren't going to be able to just keep picking up and moving to places where they have, maybe more of the leverage over employees. I think they are, or where they can just kind of leave behind one workforce and go find another one somewhere else. I think everybody's going to have to hunker down, sit across the table from each other and say, on the one hand, we're going to have to, step up and learn new skills on the employee side because things are changing, things are moving forward. We can't hold them where we were. And on the company side, I think they're going to have to be, giving a little more too. The thing I'll be fascinated to see is if that plays out as it has at different times in the past, in some sort of, you know, cooperative manner, company by company by company, or if it leads to some period of revitalization of collective activity.
I understand.
Whether it's union or, you know, whatever.
Well, we're about out of time, Kate, and I just wanted to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts today and helping our listeners better understand wayfinding and also the idea of positioning in their communities. And I would recommend to them, and hats off to you on your website. It's very well organized, and I particularly like your library. I thought that was a clever idea that you used a image of a library card catalog. I think you've really done a nice job on your website, and I think anyone would like to know more about what you do and how you do it and who you do it for would be well served. And it's katemcenroe.com, correct?
Yes, it is.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Whitaker Report podcast, Seeing Around Corners, and a special thanks to Kate McEnroe for helping us better understand the changes taking place in economic development and site selection. Again, I am Dean Whitaker, your host. Thank you for listening.